projecting bones. It walked slowly across the lawn and vanished into the shadow upon the other side. That dreaded sentinel sent a chill to my heart which I do not think that any burglar could have done. And now I have a very strange experience to tell you. I had, as you know, cut off my hair in London, and I had placed it in a great coil at the bottom of my trunk. One evening, after the child was in bed, I began to amuse myself by examining the furniture of my room and by rearranging my own little things. There was an old chest of drawers in the room, the two upper ones empty and open, the lower one locked. I'd filled the first two with my linen, and as I had still much to pack away, I was naturally annoyed at not having the use of the third drawer. It struck me that it might have been fastened by a mere oversight, so I took out my bunch of keys and tried to open it. The very first key fitted to perfection, and I drew the drawer open. There was only one thing in it, but I'm sure you would never guess what it was. It was my coil of hair. I took it up and examined it. It was of the same peculiar tint and the same thickness. But then the impossibility of the thing obtruded itself upon me. How could my hair have been locked in the drawer? With trembling hands, I undid my trunk, turned out the contents, and drew from the bottom my own hair. I laid the two tresses together, and I assure you that they were identical. Was it not extraordinary? Puzzle as I would, I could make nothing at all of what it meant. I returned the strange hair to the drawer, and I said nothing of the matter to the Rucastles, as I felt that I had put myself in the wrong by opening a drawer which they had locked. I am naturally observant, as you may have remarked, Mr. Holmes, and I soon had a pretty good plan of the whole house in my head. There was one wing, however, which appeared not to be inhabited at all. A door which faced that which led into the quarters of the Tollers opened into this suite, but it was invariably locked. One day, however, as I ascended the stair, I met Mr. Rucastle coming out through this door, his keys in his hand and a look on his face, which made him a very different person to the round, jovial man to whom I was accustomed. His cheeks were red, his brow was all crinkled with anger, and the veins stood out at his temples with passion. He locked the door and hurried past me without a word or a look. This aroused my curiosity, so when I went out for a walk in the grounds with my charge, I strolled round to the side from which I could see the windows of this part of the house. There were four of them in a row. Three of them were simply dirty, while the fourth was shuttered up. They were evidently all deserted. As I strolled up and down, glancing at them occasionally, Mr. Rucastle came out to me, looking as merry and jovial as ever. "Ah," said he, "you must not think me rude if I passed you without a word, my dear young lady. I was preoccupied with business matters." I assured him that I was not offended. "By the way," said I, "you seem to have quite a suite of spare rooms up there, and one of them has the shutters up." He looked surprised, and, as it seemed to me, a little startled at my remark. "Photography is one of my hobbies," said he. "I have made my darkroom up there. But, dear me, what an observant young lady we have come upon. Who would have believed it? Who would have ever believed it?" He spoke in a jesting tone, but there was no jest in his eyes as he looked at me. I read suspicion there, and annoyance, but no jest. "Well, Mr. Holmes, from the moment that I understood that there was something about that suite of rooms which I was not to know, I was all on fire to go over them. It was not mere curiosity, though I have my share of that. It was more a feeling of duty, a feeling that some good might come from my penetrating to this place. They talk of woman's instinct. Perhaps it was woman's instinct which gave me that feeling. At any rate, it was there, and I was keenly on the lookout for any chance to pass the forbidden door. It was only yesterday that the chance came. I may tell you that, besides Mr. Rucastle, both Mr. Toller and his wife find something to do in these deserted rooms, and I once saw him carrying a large black linen bag with him through the door. Recently he has been drinking hard, and yesterday evening he was very drunk, and when I came upstairs there was the key in the door. I have no doubt at all that he had left it there. Mr. and Mrs. Rucastle were both downstairs, and the child was with them, so that I had an admirable opportunity. I turned the key gently in the lock, opened the door, and slipped through. There was a little passage in front of me, unpapered and uncarpeted, which turned at a right angle at the farther end. Round this corner were three doors in a line, the first and third of which were open. They each led into an empty room, dusty and cheerless, with two windows in the one and one in the other, so thick with dirt that the evening light glimmered dimly through them. The centre door was closed, and across the outside of it had been fastened one of the broad bars of an iron bed, padlocked at one end to a ring in the wall, and fastened at the other with stout cord. The door itself was locked as well, and the key was not there. This barricaded door corresponded clearly with the shuttered window outside, and yet I could see by the glimmer from beneath it that the room was not in darkness. Evidently there was a skylight which let in light from above. As I stood in the passage gazing at the sinister door and wondering what secret it might veil, I suddenly heard the sound of steps within the room, and saw a shadow pass backward and forward against the little slit of dim light which shone out from under the door. A mad, unreasoning terror rose up in me at the sight, Mr. Holmes. My overstrung nerves failed me suddenly, and I turned and ran as though some dreadful hand were behind me, clutching at the skirt of my dress. I rushed down the passage, through the door, and straight into the arms of Mr. Rucastle, who was waiting outside. "So," said he, smiling, "it was you, then. I thought that it must be when I saw the door open. Oh, I am so frightened," I panted. "My dear young lady, my dear young lady." You cannot think how caressing and soothing his manner was. "And what has frightened you, my dear young lady?" But his voice was just a little too coaxing. He overdid it. I was keenly on my guard against him. "I was foolish enough to go into the empty wing," I answered, "but it is so lonely and eerie in this dim light that I was frightened and ran out again. Oh, it is so dreadfully still in there." "Only that?" said he, looking at me keenly. "Why, what did you think?" I asked. "Why do you think that I lock this door?" "I am sure that I do not know." "It is to keep people out who have no business there, do you see?" He was still smiling in the most amiable manner. "I'm sure if I had known—" "Well, then, you know now. And if you ever put your foot over that threshold again—" Here in an instant the smile hardened into a grin of rage, and he glared down at me with the face of a demon. "I'll throw you to the mastiff." I was so terrified that I do not know what I did. I suppose that I must have rushed past him into my room. I remember nothing until I found myself lying on my bed, trembling all over. Then I thought of you, Mr. Holmes. I could not live there longer without some advice. I was frightened of the house, of the man, of the woman, of the servants, even of the child. They were all horrible to me. If I could only bring you down, all would be well. Of course, I might have fled from the house, but my curiosity was almost as strong as my fears. My mind was soon made up. I would send you a wire. I put on my hat and cloak, went down to the office, which is about half a mile from the house, and then returned, feeling very much easier. A horrible doubt came into my mind as I approached the door, lest the dog might be loose, but I remembered that Toller had drunk himself into a state of insensibility that evening, and I knew that he was the only one in the household who had any influence with the savage creature, or who would venture to set him free. I slipped in safety, and lay awake half the night in my joy at the thought of seeing you. I had no difficulty in getting leave to come into Winchester this morning, but I must be back before 3 o'clock, for Mr. and Mrs. Rucastle are going on a visit and will be away all the evening, so that I must look after the child. Now I have told you all my adventures, Mr. Holmes, and I should be very glad if you could tell me what it all means, and above all, what I should do. Holmes and I had listened spellbound to this extraordinary story. My friend rose now and paced up and down the room, his hands in his pockets, and an expression of the most profound gravity upon his face. "Is Toller still drunk?" he asked. "Yes, I heard his wife tell Mrs. Rucastle that she could do nothing with him."
"That is well. And the Rucastles go out tonight?"
"Yes."
"Is there a cellar with a good strong lock?"
"Yes, the wine cellar."
"You seem to me to have acted all through this matter like a very brave and sensible girl, Miss Hunter. Do you think that you could perform one more feat? I should not ask it of you if I did not think you a quite exceptional woman."
"I will try. What is it?"
"We shall be at the Copper Beeches by 7 o'clock, my friend and I. The Rucastles will be gone by that time, and Toller will, we hope, be incapable. There only remains Mrs. Toller, who might give the alarm. If you could send her into the cellar on some errand, and then turn the key upon her, you would facilitate matters immensely."
"I will do it."
"Excellent. We shall then look thoroughly into the affair. Of course, there is only one feasible explanation. You have been brought there to personate someone, and the real person is imprisoned in this chamber. That is obvious. As to who this prisoner is, I have no doubt that it is the daughter, Miss Alice Rucastle, if I remember right, who was said to have gone to America. You were chosen, doubtless, as resembling her in height, figure, and the colour of your hair. Hers had been cut off, very possibly in some illness through which she has passed, and so, of course, yours had to be sacrificed also. By a curious chance, you came upon her tresses. The man in the road was undoubtedly some friend of hers, possibly her fiancé. And no doubt, as you wore the girl's dress and were so like her, he was convinced from your laughter whenever he saw you, and afterwards from your gesture, that Miss Rucastle was perfectly happy, and that she no longer desired his attentions. The dog is let loose at night to prevent him from endeavouring to communicate with her. So much is fairly clear. The most serious point in the case is the disposition of the child."
"What on earth has that to do with it?" I ejaculated.
"My dear Watson, you as a medical man are continually gaining light as to the tendencies of a child by the study of the parents. Don't you see that the converse is equally valid? I have frequently gained my first real insight into the character of parents by studying their children. This child's disposition is abnormally cruel, merely for cruelty's sake, and whether he derives this from his smiling father, as I should suspect, or from his mother, it bodes evil for the poor girl who is in their power."
"I am sure that you are right, Mr. Holmes," cried our client. "A thousand things come back to me which make me certain that you have hit it. Oh, let us lose not an instant in bringing help to this poor creature."
"We must be circumspect, for we are dealing with a very cunning man. We can do nothing until 7 o'clock. At that hour we shall be with you, and it will not be long before we solve the mystery." We were as good as our word, for it was just 7 when we reached the Copper Beeches, having put up our trap at a wayside public house. The group of trees, with their dark leaves shining like burnished metal in the light of the setting sun, were sufficient to mark the house, even had Miss Hunter not been standing smiling on the doorstep.
"Have you managed it?" asked Holmes.
A loud thudding noise came from somewhere downstairs.
"That is Mrs. Toller in the cellar," said she. "Her husband lies snoring on the kitchen rug. Here are his keys, which are the duplicates of Mr. Rucastle's."
"You have done well indeed," cried Holmes with enthusiasm. "Now, lead the way, and we shall soon see the end of this black business."
We passed up the stair, unlocked the door, followed on down a passage, and found ourselves in front of the barricade which Miss Hunter had described.
Holmes cut the cord and removed the transverse bar. Then he tried the various keys in the lock, but without success. No sound came from within, and at the silence, Holmes's face clouded over. "I trust that we are not too late," said he. "I think, Miss Hunter, that we had better go in without you. Now, Watson, put your shoulder to it, and we shall see whether we cannot make our way in." It was an old rickety door, and gave at once before our united strength. Together we rushed into the room. It was empty. There was no furniture, save a little pallet bed, a small table, and a basketful of linen. The skylight above was open, and the prisoner gone. "There has been some villainy here," said Holmes. "This beauty has guessed Miss Hunter's intentions and has carried his victim off. But how?" "Through the skylight. We shall soon see how he managed it." He swung himself up onto the roof. "Ah, yes," he cried. "Here's the end of a long light ladder against the eaves. That is how he did it." "But it is impossible," said Miss Hunter. "The ladder was not there when the Rucastles went away." "He has come back and done it. I tell you that he is a clever and dangerous man. I should not be very much surprised if this were he whose step I hear now upon the stair. I think, Watson, that it would be as well for you to have your pistol ready." The words were hardly out of his mouth when a man appeared at the door of the room, a very fat and burly man with a heavy stick in his hand. Miss Hunter screamed and shrunk against the wall at the sight of him. But Sherlock Holmes sprang forward and confronted him. "You villain," said he, "where's your daughter?" The fat man cast his eyes round, and then up at the open skylight. "It is for me to ask you that," he shrieked. "You thieves! Spies and thieves! I have caught you, have I? You are in my power. I'll serve you!" He turned and clattered down the stairs as hard as he could go.
"He's gone for the dog!" cried Miss Hunter.
"I have my revolver," said I. "Better close the front door," cried Holmes, and we all rushed down the stairs together. We had hardly reached the hall when we heard the baying of a hound, and then a scream of agony, with a horrible worrying sound, which it was dreadful to listen to. An elderly man with a red face and shaking limbs came staggering out at a side door.
"My God!" he cried. "Someone has loosed the dog! It's not been fed for 2 days! Quick, quick, or it'll be too late!"
Holmes and I rushed out and round the angle of the house, with Toller hurrying behind us. There was the huge famished brute, its black muzzle buried in Rucastle's throat, while he writhed and screamed upon the ground. Running up, I blew its brains out, and it fell over with its keen white teeth still meeting in the great creases of his neck. With much labour we separated them and carried him, living but horribly mangled, into the house. We laid him upon the drawing-room sofa, and having dispatched the sobered Toller to bear the news to his wife, I did what I could to relieve his pain. We were all assembled round him when the door opened and a tall, gaunt woman entered the room.
"Mrs. Toller!" cried Miss Hunter.
"Yes, miss. Mr. Rucastle let me out when he came back before he went up to you. Oh, miss, it is a pity you didn't let me know what you were planning, for I would have told you that your pains were wasted."
"Ah," said Holmes, looking keenly at her, "it is clear that Mrs. Toller knows more about this matter than anyone else."
"Yes, sir, I do, and I am ready enough to tell what I know."
"Then pray sit down and let us hear it, for there are several points on which I must confess that I am still in the dark."
"I will soon make it clear to you," said she. "And I'd have done so before now if I could have got out from the cellar. If there's police court business over this, you'll remember that I was the one that stood your friend, and that I was Miss Alice's friend, too." "She was never happy at home, Miss Alice wasn't. From the time that her father married again, she was slighted-like and had no say in anything. But it never really became bad for her until after she met Mr. Fowler at a friend's house. As well as I could learn, Miss Alice had rights of her own by will, but she was so quiet and patient, she was, that she never said a word about them, but just left everything in Mr. Rucastle's hands. He knew he was safe with her, but when there was a chance of a husband coming forward, who would ask for all that the law would give him, then her father thought it time to put a stop upon it. He wanted her to sign a paper, so that whether she married or not, he could use her money. When she wouldn't do it, he kept on worrying her until she got brain fever, and for 6 weeks was at death's door. She got better at last, all worn to a shadow, and with her beautiful hair cut off. But that didn't make no change in her young man, and he stuck to her as true as man could be.
"Ah," said Holmes, "I think that what you have been good enough to tell us makes the matter fairly clear, and that I can deduce all that remains. Mr. Rucastle, then, I presume, took to this system of imprisonment?"
"Yes, sir."
"And brought Miss Hunter down from London in order to get rid of the disagreeable persistence of Mr. Fowler?"
"That was it, sir."
"But Mr. Fowler, being a persevering man, as a good seaman should be, blockaded the house, and having met you, succeeded by certain arguments, metallic or otherwise, in convincing you that your interests were the same as his.
Mr. Fowler was a very kind-spoken, free-handed gentleman," said Mrs. Toller serenely.
"And in this way he managed that your good man should have no want of drink, and that a ladder should be ready at the moment when your master had gone out."
"You have it, sir, just as it happened."
"I'm sure we owe you an apology, Mrs. Toller," said Holmes, "for you have certainly cleared up everything which puzzled us. And here comes the country surgeon and Mrs. Rucastle. So I think, Watson, that we had best escort Miss Hunter back to Winchester, as it seems to me that our locus standi now is rather a questionable one." And thus was solved the mystery of the sinister house with the copper beeches in front of the door. Mr. Rucastle survived, but was always a broken man, kept alive solely through the care of his devoted wife. They still live with their old servants, who probably know so much of Rucastle's past life that he finds it difficult to part from them. Mr. Fowler and Miss Rucastle were married by special license in Southampton the day after their flight, and he is now the holder of a government appointment in the island of Mauritius. As to Miss Violet Hunter, my friend Holmes, rather to my disappointment, manifested no further interest in her when once she had ceased to be the centre of one of his problems, and she is now the head of a private school at Walsall, where I believe that she has met with considerable success.
The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. Foreword by Stephen Fry.
It would not be paltering with the truth for me to say that Sherlock Holmes changed my life. I started reading the stories when I was perhaps 8 or 9 years old. They very soon took the most possessive hold on my imagination. A year or so later, I saved up as much pocket money as I could and wrote off to the Sherlock Holmes Society of London to apply for membership. The Sherlock Holmes Society of London was founded in 1951, from the ashes of a pre-war society that had folded due to the Blitz and other pressing issues of the time. There are many literary societies in the world, almost all devoted to authors, poets, and playwrights. The society, as I shall call it, differs in that it is devoted to characters. It is founded on a principle known as the game. The game must be adhered to. What is the game? Let me elucidate. When I joined, the society was in full cry. The chairman was an eccentric English gentleman called Lord Gore Booth, whose day job was head of the diplomatic service. The editor of the society's magazine, the Sherlock Holmes Journal, was an equally eccentric aristocrat, Edward Arthur Donald St. George Hamilton Chichester, 6th Marquess of Donegal. My membership application was accepted, and in time I duly received my first copy of that magazine. It was in the pages of this splendid periodical that I saw some of the first traces of
the game. Example. In the famous story The Speckled Band, which Watson places in the year 1883, Holmes's client, Miss Stoker, says this. Shortly after our return to England, my mother died. She was killed 8 years ago in a railway accident near Crewe. Well, imagine my perplexity and amazement when then I saw a long and learned article in the journal in which were researched all the railway accidents in and around Crewe in the year 1875. The author of this article actually came up with a genuine report of one accident in which a woman, unnamed, was killed. This woman, the writer concluded triumphantly, can only have been the unfortunate Helen Stoker's mother. At first I was completely puzzled by this. Conan Doyle wrote the Holmes stories, and they were fiction. The novels and stories resided always in the fiction section of libraries and bookshops. What was this about Helen Stoker's mother being a real woman who really died in a railway accident? As I turned the pages, I saw more articles, paragraphs, and snippets in the journal alluding to incidents in the stories that supposed they were fact, not fiction. At last I came to a full understanding of the game. The game assumes that Sherlock Holmes was a real person who really lived at 221B Baker Street, along with a real Dr. John Watson and a real Mrs. Hudson. Moriarty was real. The adventures recounted in the novels and stories were all real, had taken place. That is all you need to know to be a Sherlockian, according to the rules of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and its venerable American confrere, the Baker Street Irregulars. The works, as related to the world by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, are called the canon, and all facts, incidents, narratives, adventures, and people who occur within the pages brought to us by Conan Doyle are referred to as canonical. Any Holmes and Watson adventure in films, rewrites, fan fiction, television series, comics, and the like may be enjoyable, but they are not canonical. The Society was best known, and is today, for its reenactments each year in Switzerland of the events of the story The Final Problem, which ends this collection of the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. Lord Gorbooth would play the part of the great detective, all dressed in tweeds and deerstalker, and another member, sometimes the Lord Marquis, sometimes a mere commoner, would play Professor Moriarty, the archest arch-villain that ever arched. Other members would play Watson and assorted Swiss innkeepers and messengers and so on. By the time I was a teenager, my passion for the game and for unearthing truthful nuggets that supported it amounted to an obsession. In looking back on my notes for the year 71, as Watson might say, I find it was in the November of that year that, aged 14 now, I applied to my housemaster at school for leave to go to London for an autumn meeting of the Society. In past times, I might have had to explain to you what a housemaster was and is, but one of many favours done to us by J.K. Rowling has been to bring the mysteries of British boarding schools into the light. And you will understand, I expect, if I say that my housemaster was my Professor McGonagall, my Professor Snape. My Hogwarts, being deep in the country, like Harry's, I needed permission to take a train to London. Yes, to King's Cross, in fact. I was allowed out of school on a Friday and was expected back on Sunday afternoon. It was an especially exciting occasion for me. For the first time, and at a record young age in the Society's history, I had been selected to present a paper to the illustrious throng of Sherlockians. I had chosen as my subject an analysis of the consonance between descriptions of Professor Moriarty and T.S. Eliot's Macavity the Mystery Cat from that poet's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. I think the Society was being kind in allowing me to present my paper as some kind of important discovery, for I'm sure they all knew that Eliot had basically put Watson's description of Moriarty into verse form. Here is Holmes describing the professor to Watson. He is extremely tall and thin. His forehead domes out in a white curve, and his two eyes are deeply sunken in his head, which is forever slowly oscillating from side to side in a curiously reptilian fashion. Here is Elliot on McCavity. He's very tall and thin, his eyes are sunken in, his brow is deeply lined with thought, his head is highly domed, he sways his head from side to side with movements like a snake. I really believed I alone had discovered this similarity, and that it was now surely only a matter of time before I would be awarded a professorship at one of the provincial universities. I waited feverishly for Lord Gorbooth to finish his learned disquisition on Holmes's French ancestry before delivering my paper to generous acclamation. It all ended, I won't say in tragedy, but in a form of disaster, or what certainly seemed disaster at the time. The day after the meeting of the society, I went to the cinema, saw four or five films, and got bitten by the movie bug. I stayed in London for four extra days, travelling from cinema to cinema. My parents were frantic when told I hadn't returned to school. When eventually I did get back, the game was up for me in every sense, and I was expelled. From that expulsion, I went to two other educational establishments with similar results, ending up in prison by the time I was 17. Happily, I raised myself up on the stepping stones of my fallen self to higher things, and went eventually to study English literature at Cambridge. I fully believe that it was the grounding in research and scholarship, however strange and specialised, and the love of reading that the Sherlockian canon inculcated in me that allowed me to escape the wilder entanglements of my troubled adolescence and to rejoin the world more or less unscathed. So I really do owe Holmes everything. As for this collection, well, it is perhaps the best of them all. It contains stories as celebrated as the opening adventure, Silver Blaze, which gave the world this fabulous exchange. Is there any point to which you would wish to draw my attention? To the curious incident of the dog in the night time. The dog did nothing in the night time. That was the curious incident, remarked Sherlock Holmes. It also introduced the world to the two great M's of the canon, Holmes's legendary smarter brother, the Diogenes Club habitué Mycroft, whom I had the honour to play opposite Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock in the film Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows, and, of course, the sinister and terrible mathematician, the Napoleon of crime, Professor James Moriarty of infamous memory. The collection ends with that great story, The Final Problem. When it was published in 1894, it astonished, excited, angered, and distressed the Sherlock Holmes-loving public more than perhaps any story that had ever been written in history. The game's afoot. Let us begin.
Silver Blaze.
"I am afraid, Watson, that I shall have to go," said Holmes, as we sat down together to our breakfast one morning.
"Go? Where to?"
"To Dartmoor, to King's Pyland."
I was not surprised.
Indeed, my only wonder was that he had not already been mixed upon this extraordinary case, which was the one topic of conversation through the length and breadth of England. For a whole day my companion had rambled about the room with his chin upon his chest and his brows knitted, charging and recharging his pipe with the strongest black tobacco, and absolutely deaf to any of my questions or remarks. Fresh editions of every paper had been sent up by our newsagent, only to be glanced over and tossed down into a corner. Yet, silent as he was, I knew perfectly well what it was over which he was brooding. There was but one problem before the public which could challenge his powers of analysis, and that was the singular disappearance of the favourite for the Wessex Cup and the tragic murder of its trainer. When, therefore, he suddenly announced his intention of setting out for the scene of the drama, it was only what I had both expected and hoped for.
"I should be most happy to go down with you if I should not be in the way," said I.
"My dear Watson, you would confer a great favour upon me by coming. And I think that your time will not be misspent, for there are points about the case which promise to make it an absolutely unique one. We have, I think, just time to catch our train at Paddington, and I will go further into the matter upon our journey.
You would oblige me by bringing with you your very excellent field glass. And so it happened that an hour or so later I found myself in the corner of a first-class carriage flying along en route for Exeter, while Sherlock Holmes, with his sharp, eager face framed in his ear-flapped travelling cap, dipped rapidly into the bundle of fresh papers which he had procured at Paddington. We had left Reading far behind us before he thrust the last one of them under the seat and offered me his cigar case. "We're going well," said he, looking out the window and glancing at his watch. "Our rate at present is 53.5 miles an hour." "I have not observed the quarter-mile posts," said I. "Nor have I. But the telegraph posts upon this line are 60 yards apart, and the calculation is a simple one. I presume that you have looked into this matter of the murder of John Straker and the disappearance of Silver Blaze?"
"I have seen what the Telegraph and the Chronicle have to say."
"It is one of those cases where the art of the reasoner should be used rather for the sifting of details than for the acquiring of fresh evidence. The tragedy has been so uncommon, so complete, and of such personal importance to so many people, that we are suffering from a plethora of surmise, conjecture, and hypothesis. The difficulty is to detach the framework of fact, of absolute, undeniable fact, from the embellishments of theorists and reporters. Then, having established ourselves upon this sound basis, it is our duty to see what inferences may be drawn, and what are the special points upon which the whole mystery turns. On Tuesday evening, I received telegrams from both Colonel Ross, the owner of the horse, and from Inspector Gregory, who is looking after the case, inviting my cooperation."
"Tuesday evening?" I exclaimed. "And this is Thursday morning. Why didn't you go down yesterday?"
"Because I made a blunder, my dear Watson, which is, I am afraid, a more common occurrence than anyone would think who only knew me through your memoirs. The fact is that I could not believe it possible that the most remarkable horse in England could long remain concealed, especially in so sparsely inhabited a place as the north of Dartmoor. From hour to hour yesterday, I expected to hear that he had been found, and that his abductor was the murderer of John Straker. When, however, another morning had come, and I found that beyond the arrest of young Fitzroy Simpson, nothing had been done, I felt that it was time for me to take action. Yet in some ways, I feel that yesterday has not been wasted."
"You have formed a theory, then?"
"At least I have got a grip of the essential facts of the case. I shall enumerate them to you, for nothing clears up a case so much as stating it to another person, and I can hardly expect your cooperation if I do not show you the position from which we start." I lay back against the cushions, puffing at my cigar, while Holmes, leaning forward with his long, thin forefinger, checking off the points upon the palm of his left hand, gave me a sketch of the events which had led to our journey. "Silver Blaze," said he, "is from the Isonomy stock, and holds as brilliant a record as his famous ancestor. He is now in his 5th year, and has brought in turn each of the prizes of the turf to Colonel Ross, his fortunate owner. Up to the time of the catastrophe, he was the first favourite for the Wessex Cup, the betting being 3-1 on him. He has always, however, been a prime favourite with the racing public, and has never yet disappointed them, so that even at those odds, enormous sums of money have been laid upon him. It is obvious, therefore, that there were many people who had the strongest interest in preventing Silver Blaze from being there at the fall of the flag next Tuesday. The fact was, of course, appreciated at King's Pyland, where the Colonel's training stable is situated. Every precaution was taken to guard the favourite. The trainer, John Straker, is a retired jockey who rode in Colonel Ross's colours before he became too heavy for the weighing chair. He has served the Colonel for 5 years as jockey and for 7 as trainer, and has always shown himself to be a zealous and honest servant. Under him were 3 lads, for the establishment was a small one,
containing only 4 horses in all. One of these lads sat up each night in the stable, while the others slept in the loft. All 3 bore excellent characters. John Straker, who is a married man, lived in a small villa about 200 yards from the stables. He has no children, keeps 1 maidservant, and is comfortably off. The country round is very lonely, but about 1/2 mile to the north there is a small cluster of villas which have been built by a Tavistock contractor for the use of invalids and others who may wish to enjoy the pure Dartmoor air. Tavistock itself lies 2 miles to the west, while across the moor, also about 2 miles distant, is the larger training establishment of Mapleton, which belongs to Lord Backwater, and is managed by Silas Brown. In every other direction, the moor is a complete wilderness, inhabited only by a few roaming gypsies. Such was the general situation last Monday night when the catastrophe occurred. On that evening, the horses had been exercised and watered as usual, and the stables were locked up at 9 o'clock. 2 of the lads walked up to the trainer's house, where they had supper in the kitchen, while the 3rd, Ned Hunter, remained on guard. At a few minutes after 9, the maid, Edith Baxter, carried down to the stables his supper, which consisted of a dish of curried mutton. She took no liquid, as there was a water tap in the stables, and it was the rule that the lad on duty should drink nothing else. The maid carried a lantern with her, as it was very dark, and the path ran across the open moor. Edith Baxter was within 30 yards of the stables when a man appeared out of the darkness and called to her to stop. As he stepped into the circle of yellow light thrown by the lantern, she saw that he was a person of gentlemanly bearing, dressed in a grey suit of tweeds and a cloth cap. He wore gaiters and carried a heavy stick with a knob to it. She was most impressed, however, by the extreme pallor of his face and by the nervousness of his manner. His age, she thought, would be rather over 30 than under it. "Can you tell me where I am?" he asked. "I had almost made up my mind to sleep on the moor when I saw the light of your lantern." "You are close to the King's Pyland training stables," said she. "Oh, indeed! What a stroke of luck!" he cried. "I understand that a stable boy sleeps there alone every night. Perhaps that is his supper which you are carrying to him. Now I am sure that you would not be too proud to earn the price of a new dress, would you?" He took a piece of white paper folded up out of his waistcoat pocket. "See that the boy has this tonight, and you shall have the prettiest frock that money can buy." She was frightened by the earnestness of his manner, and ran past him to the window through which she was accustomed to hand the meals. It was already opened, and Hunter was seated at the small table inside. She had begun to tell him of what had happened when the stranger came up again. "Good evening," said he, looking through the window. "I wanted to have a word with you." The girl has sworn that as he spoke, she noticed the corner of the little paper packet protruding from his closed hand. "What business have you here?" asked the lad. "It's business that may put something into your pocket," said the other. "You've 2 horses in for the Wessex Cup, Silver Blaze and Bayard. Let me have the straight tip, and you won't be a loser. Is it a fact that at the weights Bayard could give the other 100 yards in 5 furlongs, and at the stable have put their money on him?" "So you're one of those damned touts," cried the lad. "I'll show you how we serve them in King's Pyland." He sprang up and rushed across the stable to unloose the dog. The girl fled away to the house, but as she ran, she looked back and saw that the stranger was leaning through the window. A minute later, however, when Hunter rushed out with the hound, he was gone, and though he ran all round the buildings, he failed to find any trace of him. "One moment," I asked. "Did the stable boy, when he ran out with the dog, leave the door unlocked behind him?" "Excellent, Watson, excellent," murmured my companion. "The importance of the point struck me so forcibly
that I sent a special wire to Dartmoor yesterday to clear the matter up. The boy locked the door before he left it. The window, I may add, was not large enough for a man to get through. Hunter waited until his fellow grooms had returned, when he sent a message to the trainer and told him what had occurred. Straker was excited at hearing the account, although he does not seem to have quite realized its true significance. It left him, however, vaguely uneasy, and Mrs. Straker, waking at 1 in the morning, found that he was dressing. In reply to her inquiries, he said that he could not sleep on account of his anxiety about the horses, and that he intended to walk down to the stables to see that all was well. She begged him to remain at home, as she could hear the rain pattering against the window, but in spite of her entreaties, he pulled on his large mackintosh and left the house. Mrs. Straker awoke at 7 in the morning to find that her husband had not yet returned. She dressed herself hastily, called the maid, and set off for the stables. The door was open. Inside, huddled together upon a chair, Hunter was sunk in a state of absolute stupor. The favourite stall was empty, and there were no signs of his trainer. The two lads who slept in the chaff-cutting loft above the harness room were quickly aroused. They had heard nothing during the night, for they are both sound sleepers. Hunter was obviously under the influence of some powerful drug, and as no sense could be got out of him, he was left to sleep it off, while the two lads and the two women ran out in search of the absentees. They still had hopes that the trainer had, for some reason, taken out the horse for early exercise. But on ascending the knoll near the house, from which all the neighbouring moors were visible, they not only could see no signs of the missing favourite, but they perceived something which warned them that they were in the presence of a tragedy. About a quarter of a mile from the stables, John Straker's overcoat was flapping from a furze bush. Immediately beyond, there was a bowl-shaped depression in the moor, and at the bottom of this was found the dead body of the unfortunate trainer. His head had been shattered by a savage blow from some heavy weapon, and he was wounded on the thigh, where there was a long, clean cut, inflicted evidently by some very sharp instrument. It was clear, however, that Straker had defended himself vigorously against his assailants, for in his right hand he held a small knife, which was clotted with blood up to the handle, while in his left he clasped a red and black silk cravat, which was recognized by the maid as having been worn on the preceding evening by the stranger who had visited the stables. Hunter, on recovering from his stupor, was also quite positive as to the ownership of the cravat. He was equally certain that the same stranger had, while standing at the window, drugged his curried mutton, and so deprived the stables of their watchman. As to the missing horse, there were abundant proofs in the mud which lay at the bottom of the fatal hollow that he had been there at the time of the struggle. But from that morning he has disappeared, and although a large reward has been offered, and all the gypsies of Dartmoor are on the alert, no news has come of him. Finally, an analysis has shown that the remains of his supper left by the stable lad contained an appreciable quantity of powdered opium, while the people at the house partook of the same dish on the same night without any ill effect. Those are the main facts of the case, stripped of all surmise and stated as baldly as possible. I shall now recapitulate what the police have done in the matter. Inspector Gregory, to whom the case has been committed, is an extremely competent officer. Were he but gifted with imagination, he might rise to great heights in his profession. On his arrival, he promptly found and arrested the man upon whom suspicion naturally rested. There was little difficulty in finding him, for he inhabited one of those villas which I have mentioned. His name, it appears, was Fitzroy Simpson. He was a man of excellent birth and education, who had squandered a fortune upon the turf, and who lived now by doing a little quiet and genteel bookmaking in the sporting clubs of London. An examination of his betting book shows that bets to the amount of £5,000 had been registered by him against the favourite. On being arrested, he volunteered that statement that he had come down to Dartmoor in the hope of getting some information about the King's Pyland horses, and also about Desborough, the second favourite, which was in charge of Silas Brown at the Mapleton stables. He did not attempt to deny that he had acted as described upon the evening before, but declared that he had no sinister designs, and had simply wished to obtain first-hand information. When confronted with his cravat, he turned very pale, and was utterly unable to account for its presence in the hand of the murdered man. His wet clothing showed that he had been out in the storm of the night before, and his stick, which was a Penang lawyer, weighted with lead, was just such a weapon as might, by repeated blows, have inflicted the terrible injuries to which the trainer had succumbed. On the other hand, there was no wound upon his person, while the state of Straker's knife would show that one at least of his assailants must bear his mark upon him. There you have it all, in a nutshell, Watson. And if you can give me any light, I shall be infinitely obliged to you.
I had listened with the greatest interest to the statement which Holmes, with characteristic clearness, had laid before me. Though most of the facts were familiar to me, I had not sufficiently appreciated their relative importance, nor their connection to each other.
"Is it not possible," I suggested, "that the incised wound upon Straker may have been caused by his own knife in the convulsive struggles which follow any brain injury?"
"It is more than possible, it is probable," said Holmes. "In that case, one of the main points in favour of the accused disappears."
"And yet," said I, "even now I fail to understand what the theory of the police can be."
"I am afraid that whatever theory we state has very grave objections to it," returned my companion. "The police imagine, I take it, that this Fitzroy Simpson, having drugged the lad, and having in some way obtained a duplicate key, opened the stable door and took out the horse with the intention, apparently, of kidnapping him altogether. His bridle is missing, so that Simpson must have put this on. Then, having left the door open behind him, he was leading the horse away over the moor when he was either met or overtaken by the trainer. A row naturally ensued. Simpson beat out the trainer's brains with his heavy stick, without receiving any injury from the small knife which Straker used in self-defence, and then the thief either led the horse on to some secret hiding-place, or else it may have bolted during the struggle and be now wandering out on the moors. That is the case as it appears to the police, and improbable as it is, all other explanations are more improbable still. However, I shall very quickly test the matter when I am once upon the spot, and until then I cannot really see how we can get much further than our present position."
It was evening before we reached the little town of Tavistock, which lies, like the boss of a shield, in the middle of the huge circle of Dartmoor. Two gentlemen were awaiting us in the station, the one a tall, fair man with lion-like hair and beard and curiously penetrating light-blue eyes, the other a small, alert person, very neat and dapper, in a frock-coat and gaiters, with trim little side-whiskers and an eyeglass. The latter was Colonel Ross, the well-known sportsman, the other Inspector Gregory, a man who was rapidly making his name in the English detective service.
"I'm delighted that you have come down, Mr. Holmes," said the Colonel. "The inspector here has done all that could possibly be suggested, but I wish to leave no stone unturned in trying to avenge poor Straker and in recovering my horse."
"Have there been any fresh developments?" asked Holmes.
"I'm sorry to say that we have made very little progress," said the inspector. "We have an open carriage outside, and as you would no doubt like to see the place before the light fails, we might talk it over as we drive."
A minute later we were all seated in a comfortable landau and were rattling through the quaint old Devonshire city.
Inspector Gregory was full of his case and poured out a stream of remarks, while Holmes threw in an occasional question or interjection. Colonel Ross leaned back with his arms folded and his hat tilted over his eyes, while I listened with interest to the dialogue of the two detectives. Gregory was formulating his theory, which was almost exactly what Holmes had foretold in the train. "The net is drawn pretty close round Fitzroy Simpson," he remarked, "and I believe myself that he is our man. At the same time, I recognise that the evidence is purely circumstantial, and that some new development may upset it. How about Straker's knife? We have quite come to the conclusion that he wounded himself in his fall. My friend Dr. Watson made that suggestion to me as we came down. If so, it would tell against this man Simpson." "Undoubtedly. He has neither a knife nor any sign of a wound. The evidence against him is certainly very strong. He had a great interest in the disappearance of the favourite. He lies under suspicion of having poisoned the stable boy. He was undoubtedly out in the storm. He was armed with a heavy stick, and his cravat was found in the dead man's hand. I really think we have enough to go before a jury." Holmes shook his head. "A clever counsel would tear it all to rags," said he. "Why should he take the horse out of the stable? If he wished to injure it, why could he not do it in there? Has a duplicate key been found in his possession? What chemist sold him the powdered opium above all? Where could he, a stranger to the district, hide a horse, and such a horse as this? What is his own explanation as to the paper which he wished the maid to give to the stable boy? He says that it was a £10 note. One was found in his purse, but your other difficulties are not so formidable as they seem. He is not a stranger to the district. He has twice lodged at Tavistock in the summer. The opium was probably brought from London. The key, having served its purpose, would be hurled away. The horse may be at the bottom of one of the pits or old mines upon the moor. What does he say about the cravat? He acknowledges that it is his, and declares that he had lost it. But a new element has been introduced into the case, which may account for his leading the horse from the stable." Holmes pricked up his ears. "We have found traces which show that a party of gypsies encamped on Monday night within a mile of the spot where the murder took place. On Tuesday they were gone. Now, presuming that there was some understanding between Simpson and these gypsies, might he not have been leading the horse to them when he was overtaken, and may they not have him now?"
"It is certainly possible."
"The moor is being scoured for these gypsies. I have also examined every stable and outhouse in Tavistock for a radius of 10 miles.
There is another training stable quite close, I understand."
"Yes, and that is a factor which we must certainly not neglect. As Desborough, their horse, was second in the betting, they had an interest in the disappearance of the favourite. Silas Brown, the trainer, is known to have had large bets upon the event, and he was no friend to poor Straker. We have, however, examined the stables, and there is nothing to connect him with the affair. And nothing to connect this man Simpson with the interests of the Mapleton stables? Nothing at all." Holmes leaned back in the carriage, and the conversation ceased. A few minutes later, our driver pulled up at a neat little red-brick villa with overhanging eaves, which stood by the road. Some distance off, across a paddock, lay a long, grey-tiled outbuilding. In every other direction, the low curves of the moor, bronze-coloured from the fading ferns, stretched away to the skyline, broken only by the steeples of Tavistock and by a cluster of houses away to the westward, which marked the Mapleton stables. We all sprang out, with the exception of Holmes, who continued to lean back with his eyes fixed upon the sky in front of him, entirely absorbed in his own thoughts. It was only when I touched his arm that he roused himself with a violent start and stepped out of the carriage. "Excuse me," said he, turning to Colonel Ross, who had looked at him in some surprise. "I was daydreaming. There was a gleam in his eyes and a suppressed excitement in his manner which convinced me, used as I was to his ways, that his hand was upon a clue, though I could not imagine where he had found it.
"Perhaps you would prefer at once to go on to the scene of the crime, Mr. Holmes," said Gregory.
"I think that I should prefer to stay here a little and go into one or two questions of detail. Straker was brought back here, I presume?"
"Yes, he lies upstairs. The inquest is tomorrow."
"He has been in your service some years, Colonel Ross?"
"I have always found him an excellent servant."
"I presume that you made an inventory of what he had in his pockets at the time of his death, Inspector?"
"I have the things themselves in the sitting-room, if you would care to see them."
"I should be very glad."
We all filed into the front room and sat round the central table while the inspector unlocked a square tin box and laid a small heap of things before us. There was a box of Vestas, 2 inches of tallow candle, an ADP briar root pipe, a pouch of sealskin with 1/2 ounce of long-cut Cavendish, a silver watch with a gold chain, 5 sovereigns in gold, an aluminium pencil case, a few papers, and an ivory-handled knife with a very delicate, inflexible blade marked Weiss & Company, London.
"This is a very singular knife," said Holmes, lifting it up and examining it minutely. "I presume, as I see bloodstains upon it, that it is the one which was found in the dead man's grasp. Watson, this knife is surely in your line."
"It is what we call a cataract knife," said I.
"I thought so. A very delicate blade, devised for very delicate work. A strange thing for a man to carry with him upon a rough expedition, especially as it would not shut in his pocket."
"The tip was guarded by a disc of cork, which we found beside his body," said the inspector. "His wife tells us that the knife had lain upon the dressing-table, and that he had picked it up as he left the room. It was a poor weapon, but perhaps the best that he could lay his hands on at the moment."
"Very possible. How about these papers?"
3 of them are receipted hay dealers' accounts. One of them is a letter of instructions from Colonel Ross. The other is a milliner's account for £37.15, made out by Madame Le Surier of Bond Street to William Derbyshire. Mrs. Straker tells us that Derbyshire was a friend of her husband's, and that occasionally his letters were addressed here."
"Madame Derbyshire has somewhat expensive tastes," remarked Holmes, glancing down the account. 22 guineas is rather heavy for a single costume. However, there appears to be nothing more to learn, and we may now go down to the scene of the crime."
As we emerged from the sitting-room, a woman who had been waiting in the passage took a step forward and laid her hand upon the inspector's sleeve. Her face was haggard and thin and eager, stamped with the print of a recent horror.
"Have you got them? Have you found them?"
she panted.
"No, Mrs. Straker, but Mr. Holmes here has come from London to help us, and we shall do all that is possible."
"Surely I met you in Plymouth at a garden party some little time ago, Mrs. Straker?" said Holmes.
"No, sir, you are mistaken."
"Dear me, why, I could have sworn to it. You wore a costume of dove-coloured silk with ostrich-feather trimming."
"I never had such a dress, sir,"
answered the lady.
"Oh, that quite settles it," said Holmes, and with an apology he followed the inspector outside.
A short walk across the moor took us to the hollow in which the body had been found. At the brink of it was the furze bush upon which the coat had been hung.
"There was no wind that night, I understand," said Holmes.
"None, but very heavy rain."
"In that case the overcoat was not blown against the furze bush, but placed there."
"Yes, it was laid across the bush."
"You fill me with interest.
I perceive that the ground has been trampled up a good deal. No doubt many feet have been here since Monday night."
"A piece of matting has been laid here at the side, and we have all stood upon that."
"Excellent. In this bag I have one of the boots which Straker wore, one of Fitzroy Simpson's shoes, and a cast horseshoe of Silver Blaze." "My dear Inspector, you surpass yourself." Holmes took the bag, and descending into the hollow, he pushed the matting into a more central position. Then, stretching himself upon his face and leaning his chin upon his hands, he made a careful study of the trampled mud in front of him.
"Hello," said he, suddenly. "What's this?"
It was a wax vesta, half-burned, which was so coated with mud that it looked at first like a little chip of wood. "I cannot think how I came to overlook it," said the inspector, with an expression of annoyance. "It was invisible, buried in the mud. I only saw it because I was looking for it."
"What? You expected to find it?"
"I thought it not unlikely." He took the boots from the bag and compared the impressions of each of them with marks upon the ground. Then he clambered up to the rim of the hollow and crawled about among the ferns and bushes. "I'm afraid there are no more tracks," said the inspector. "I have examined the ground very carefully for 100 yards in each direction."
"Indeed," said Holmes, rising. "I should not have the impertinence to do it again after what you say, but I should like to take a little walk over the moor before it grows dark, that I may know my ground tomorrow, and I think that I shall put this horseshoe into my pocket, for luck."
Colonel Ross, who had shown some signs of impatience at my companion's quiet and systematic method of work, glanced at his watch.
"I wish you would come back with me, Inspector," said he. "There are several points on which I should like your advice, and especially as to whether we do not owe it to the public to remove our horse's name from the entries for the cup."
"Certainly not," cried Holmes with decision. "I should let the name stand." The Colonel bowed.
"I am very glad to have your opinion, sir," said he. "You will find us at poor Straker's house when you have finished your walk, and we can drive together into Tavistock."
He turned back with the inspector, while Holmes and I walked slowly across the moor. The sun was beginning to sink behind the stables of Mapleton, and the long, sloping plain in front of us was tinged with gold, deepening into rich, ruddy browns where the faded ferns and brambles caught the evening light. But the glories of the landscape were all wasted upon my companion, who was sunk in the deepest thought.
"It's this way, Watson," said he at last. "We may leave the question of who killed John Straker for the instant, and confine ourselves to finding out what has become of the horse. Now, supposing that he broke away during or after the tragedy, where could he have gone to? The horse is a very gregarious creature. If left to himself, his instincts would have been either to return to King's Pyland or go over to Mapleton. Why should he run wild upon the moor? He would surely have been seen by now. And why should gypsies kidnap him? These people always clear out when they hear of trouble, but they do not wish to be pestered by the police. They could not hope to sell such a horse. They would run a great risk and gain nothing by taking him. Surely that is clear.
Where is he, then?"
"I have already said that he must have gone to King's Pyland or to Mapleton. He is not at King's Pyland, therefore he is at Mapleton. Let us take that as a working hypothesis and see what it leads to. This part of the moor, as the inspector remarked, is very hard and dry, but it falls away towards Mapleton, and you can see from here that there is a long hollow over yonder, which must have been very wet on Monday night. If our supposition is correct, then the horse must have crossed that, and there is the point where we should look for his tracks."
We had been walking briskly during this conversation, and a few more minutes brought us to the hollow in question. At Holmes' request, I walked down the bank to the right, and he to the left, but I had not taken 50 paces before I heard him give a shout and saw him waving his hand to me. The track of a horse was plainly outlined in the soft earth in front of him, and the shoe which he took from his pocket exactly fitted the impression.
"See the value of imagination," said Holmes. "It is the one quality which Gregory lacks. We imagined what might have happened,
acted upon the supposition, and find ourselves justified. Let us proceed.
We crossed the marshy bottom and passed over a quarter of a mile of dry, hard turf. Again the ground sloped, and again we came on the tracks. Then we lost them for half a mile, but only to pick them up once more, quite close to Mapleton. It was Holmes who saw them first, and he stood pointing with a look of triumph upon his face. A man's track was visible beside the horse's.
"The horse was alone before!" I cried.
"Quite so. It was alone before. Hello! What is this?" The double track turned sharp off and took the direction of King's Pyland. Holmes whistled, and we both followed along after it. His eyes were on the trail, but I happened to look a little to one side and saw, to my surprise, the same tracks coming back again in the opposite direction.
"One for you, Watson," said Holmes, when I pointed it out.
"You have saved us a long walk which would have brought us back on our own traces. Let us follow the return track."
We had not to go far. It ended at the paving of asphalt which led up to the gates of the Mapleton stables. As we approached, a groom ran out from them.
"We don't want any loiterers about here," said he.
"I only wish to ask a question," said Holmes, with his finger and thumb in his waistcoat pocket. "Should I be too early to see your master, Mr. Silas Brown, if I were to call at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning?"
"Bless you, sir, if anyone is about, he will be, for he is always the first stirring. But here he is, sir, to answer your questions for himself."
"No, no, sir, no. It is as much as my place is worth to let him see me touch your money afterwards, if you like."
As Sherlock Holmes replaced the half-crown which he had drawn from his pocket, a fierce-looking elderly man strode out from the gate with a hunting crop swinging in his hand.
"What's this, Dawson?" he cried. "No gossiping! Go about your business! And you, what the devil do you want here?"
10 minutes' talk with you, my good sir," said Holmes, in the sweetest of voices.
"I've no time to talk to every gadabout. We want no stranger here. Be off, or you may find a dog at your heels."
Holmes leaned forward and whispered something in the trainer's ear. He started violently and flushed to the temples.
"It's a lie!" he shouted. "An infernal lie!"
"Very good. Shall we argue about it here in public, or talk it over in your parlour?"
"Don't come in if you wish to."
Holmes smiled. "I shall not keep you more than a few minutes, Watson," said he. "Now, Mr. Brown, I am quite at your disposal." It was 20 minutes, and the reds had all faded into greys before Holmes and the trainer reappeared. Never have I seen such a change as had been brought about in Silas Brown in that short time. His face was ashy pale, beads of perspiration shone upon his brow, and his hands shook until the hunting crop wagged like a branch in the wind. His bullying, overbearing manner was all gone too, and he cringed along at my companion's side like a dog with its master.
"Your instructions will be done. It shall all be done," said he.
"There must be no mistake," said Holmes, looking round at him. The other winced as he read the menace in his eyes.
"Oh, no, there shall be no mistake. It shall be there. Should I change it first or not?"
Holmes thought a little and then burst out laughing.
"No, don't," said he. "I shall write to you about it. No tricks now, or—"
"Oh, you can trust me. You can trust me." "Yes, I think I can."
"Well, you shall hear from me tomorrow." He turned upon his heel, disregarding the trembling hand which the other held out to him, and we set off for King's Pyland.
A more perfect compound of the bully, coward, and sneak than Master Silas Brown I have seldom met with," remarked Holmes as we trudged along together.
"He has the horse, then?"
"He tried to bluster out of it, but I described to him so exactly what his actions had been upon that morning that he is convinced that I was watching him, Of course, you observed the peculiarly square toes in the impressions, and that his own boots exactly corresponded to them. Again, of course, no subordinate would have dared to do such a thing. I described to him how, when according to his custom he was the first down, he perceived a strange horse wandering over the moor. How he went out to it, and his astonishment at recognizing, from the white forehead which has given the favourite its name, that chance had put in his power the only horse which could beat the one upon which he had put his money. Then I described how his first impulse had been to lead him back to King's Pyland, and how the devil had shown him how he could hide the horse until the race was over, and how he had led it back and concealed it at Mapleton. When I told him every detail, he gave it up and thought only of saving his own skin. But his stables had been searched. Oh, an old horse fakir like him has many a dodge. But are you not afraid to leave the horse in his power now, since he has every interest in injuring it? My dear fellow, he will guard it as the apple of his eye. He knows that his only hope of mercy is to produce it safe.
Colonel Ross did not impress me as a man who would be likely to show much mercy in any case.
The matter does not rest with Colonel Ross. I follow my own methods, and tell as much or as little as I choose. That is the advantage of being unofficial. I don't know whether you observed it, Watson, but the Colonel's manner has been just a trifle cavalier to me. I'm inclined now to have a little amusement at his expense. Say nothing to him about the horse.
Certainly not without your permission.
And, of course, this is all quite a minor point compared to the question of who killed John Straker.
And you will devote yourself to that?
On the contrary, we both go back to London by the night train. I was thunderstruck by my friend's words. We had only been a few hours in Devonshire, and that he should give up an investigation which he had begun so brilliantly was quite incomprehensible to me. Not a word more could I draw from him until we were back at the trainer's house. The Colonel and the Inspector were awaiting us in the parlour. "My friend and I returned to town by the night express," said Holmes. "We have had a charming little breath of your beautiful Dartmoor air." The Inspector opened his eyes, and the Colonel's lip curled in a sneer. "So you despair of arresting the murderer of poor Straker?" said he. Holmes shrugged his shoulders. "There are certainly grave difficulties in the way," said he. "I have every hope, however, that your horse will start upon Tuesday, and I beg that you will have your jockey in readiness. Might I ask for a photograph of Mr. John Straker?" The Inspector took one from an envelope and handed it to him. "My dear Gregory, you anticipate all my wants. If I might ask you to wait here for an instant, I have a question which I should like to put to the maid."
"I must say that I'm rather disappointed in our London consultant," said Colonel Ross bluntly, as my friend left the room. "I do not see that we are any further than when he came."
"At least you have his assurance that your horse will run," said I.
"Yes, I have his assurance," said the Colonel, with a shrug of his shoulders. "I should prefer to have the horse."
I was about to make some reply in defence of my friend when he entered the room again. "Now, gentlemen," said he, "I am quite ready for Tavistock." As we stepped into the carriage, one of the stable lads held the door open for us. A sudden idea seemed to occur to Holmes, for he leaned forward and touched the lad upon the sleeve. "You have a few sheep in the paddock," he said. "Who attends to them?"
"I do, sir."
"Have you noticed anything amiss with them of late?"
"Well, sir, not of much account, but three of them have gone lame, sir."
I could see that Holmes was extremely pleased, for he chuckled and rubbed his hands together. "A long shot, Watson, a very long shot," said he, pinching my arm. "Gregory,
let me recommend to your attention this singular epidemic among the sheep. Drive on, coachman."
Colonel Ross still wore an expression which showed the poor opinion which he had formed of my companion's ability, but I saw by the inspector's face that his attention had been keenly aroused.
"You consider that to be important?" he asked.
"Exceedingly so."
"Is there any point to which you would wish to draw my attention?"
"To the curious incident of the dog in the night time."
"The dog did nothing in the night time."
"That was the curious incident," remarked Sherlock Holmes. 4 days later, Holmes and I were again in the train, bound for Winchester, to see the race for the Wessex Cup. Colonel Ross met us by appointment outside the station, and we drove in his drag to the course beyond the town. His face was grave, and his manner was cold in the extreme. "I have seen nothing of my horse," said he.
"I suppose that you would know him when you saw him?" asked Holmes.
The Colonel was very angry.
"I have been on the turf for 20 years, and never was asked such a question as that before," said he. "A child would know Silver Blaze, with his white forehead and his mottled-off foreleg."
"How is the betting?"
"Well, that is the curious part of it. You could have got 15 to 1 yesterday, but the price has become shorter and shorter until you can hardly get 3 to 1 now."
"Hmm," said Holmes. "Somebody knows something, that is clear." As the drag drew up in the enclosure near the grandstand, I glanced at the card to see the entries. "Wessex Plate," it ran. 50 sovereigns each half forfeit, with 1,000 sovereigns added for 4- and 5-year-olds. Second, £300. Third, £200. New course, 1 mile and 5 furlongs. Mr. Heath Newton's The Negro, red cap, cinnamon jacket. Colonel Wardlaw's Pugilist, pink cap, blue and black jacket. Lord Backwater's Desborough, yellow cap and sleeves. Colonel Ross's Silver Blaze, black cap, red jacket. Duke of Balmoral's Iris, yellow and black stripes. Lord Singleford's Rasper, purple cap, black sleeves. "We scratched our other one and put all our hopes on your word," said the Colonel.
"Why, what is that? Silver Blaze favourite?"
5 to 4 against Silver Blaze," roared the ring. 5 to 4 against Silver Blaze. 5 to 15 against Desborough. 5 to 4 on the field."
"There are the numbers up," I cried.
"They're all 6 there."
"All 6 there? Then my horse is running," cried the Colonel in great agitation. "But I don't see him. My colours have not passed."
"Only 5 have passed. This must be he." As I spoke, a powerful bay horse swept out from the waiting enclosure and cantered past us, bearing on its back the well-known black and red of the Colonel.
"That's not my horse," cried the owner. "That beast has not a white hair upon its body. What is this that you have done, Mr. Holmes?"
"Well, well, let us see how he gets on," said my friend imperturbably. For a few minutes he gazed through my field-glass.
"Capital! An excellent start!" he cried suddenly. "There they are, coming round the curve."
From our drag we had a superb view as they came up the straight. The 6 horses were so close together that a carpet could have covered them, but halfway up the yellow of the Mapleton stable showed to the front. Before they reached us, however, Desborough's bolt was shot, and the Colonel's horse, coming away with a rush, passed the post a good 6 lengths before its rival, the Duke of Balmoral's Iris, making a bad 3rd.
"It's my race, anyhow," gasped the Colonel, passing his hand over his eyes. "I confess that I can make neither head nor tail of it. Don't you think that you have kept up your mystery long enough, Mr. Holmes?"
"Certainly, Colonel, you shall know everything. Let us all go round and have a look at the horse together. Here he is," he continued, as we made our way into the weighing enclosure, where only owners and their friends find admittance. "You have only to wash his face and his leg in spirits of wine, and you will find that he is the same old Silver Blaze as ever."
You take my breath away.
I found him in the hands of a fakir and took the liberty of running him just as he was sent over.
My dear sir, you have done wonders. The horse looks very fit and well. It never went better in its life. I owe you 1,000 apologies for having doubted your ability. You have done me a great service by recovering my horse. You would do me a greater still if you could lay your hands on the murderer of John Straker.
I have done so, said Holmes quietly.
The Colonel and I stared at him in amazement.
You have got him? Where is he, then?
He is here.
Here? Where?
In my company at the present moment.
The Colonel flushed angrily.
I quite recognize that I am under obligations to you, Mr. Holmes, said he, but I must regard what you have just said as either a very bad joke or an insult.
Sherlock Holmes laughed.
I assure you that I have not associated you with the crime, Colonel, said he. The real murderer is standing immediately behind you. He stepped past and laid his hand upon the glossy neck of the thoroughbred.
The horse?
Cried both the Colonel and myself.
Yes, the horse.
And it may lessen his guilt if I say that it was done in self-defence, and that John Straker was a man who was entirely unworthy of your confidence. But there goes the bell, and as I stand to win a little on this next race, I shall defer a lengthy explanation until a more fitting time. We had the corner of a Pullman car to ourselves that evening as we whirled back to London, and I fancy that the journey was a short one to Colonel Ross as well as to myself, as we listened to our companion's narrative of the events which had occurred at the Dartmoor training stables upon the Monday night, and the means by which he had unravelled them.
"I confess," said he, "that any theories which I had formed from the newspaper reports were entirely erroneous. And yet there were indications there, had they not been overlaid by other details which concealed their true import. I went to Devonshire with the conviction that Fitzroy Simpson was the true culprit, although, of course, I saw that the evidence against him was by no means complete. It was while I was in the carriage, just as we reached the trainer's house, that the immense significance of the curried mutton occurred to me. You may remember that I was distrait and remained sitting after you had all alighted. I was marvelling in my own mind how I could possibly have overlooked so obvious a clue.
I confess, said the Colonel, that even now I cannot see how it helps us. It was the first link in my chain of reasoning. Powdered opium is by no means tasteless. The flavour is not disagreeable, but it is perceptible. Were it mixed with any ordinary dish, the eater would undoubtedly detect it, and would probably eat no more. A curry was exactly the medium which would disguise this taste. By no possible supposition could this stranger, Fitzroy Simpson, have caused curry to be served in the trainer's family that night, and it is surely too monstrous a coincidence to suppose that he happened to come along with powdered opium upon the very night when a dish happened to be served which would disguise the flavour. That is unthinkable. Therefore, Simpson becomes eliminated from the case, and our attention centres upon Straker and his wife, the only two people who could have chosen curried mutton for supper that night. The opium was added after the dish was set aside for the stable boy, for the others had the same for supper with no ill effects. Which of them, then, had access to that dish without the maid seeing them? Before deciding that question, I had grasped the significance of the silence of the dog. For one true inference invariably suggests others. The Simpson incident had shown me that a dog was kept in the stables, and yet, though someone had been in and fetched out a horse, he had not barked enough to arouse the two lads in the loft. Obviously, the midnight visitor was someone whom the dog knew well. I was already convinced, or almost convinced, that John Straker went down to the stables in the dead of the night and took out Silver Blaze. For what purpose? For a dishonest one, obviously, or why should he drug his own stable boy? And yet I was at a loss to know why. There have been cases before now where trainers have made sure of great sums of money by laying against their own horses through agents, and then preventing them from winning by fraud. Sometimes it is a pulling jockey, sometimes it is some surer and subtler means. What was it here? I hoped that the contents of his pockets might help me to form a conclusion. And they did so. You cannot have forgotten the singular knife which was found in the dead man's hand, a knife which certainly no sane man would choose for a weapon. It was, as Dr. Watson told us, a form of knife which is used for the most delicate operations known in surgery, and it was to be used for a delicate operation that night. You must know, with your wide experience of turf matters, Colonel Ross, that it is possible to make a slight nick upon the tendons of a horse's ham, and to do it subcutaneously, so as to leave absolutely no trace. A horse so treated would develop a slight lameness, which would be put down to a strain in exercise or a touch of rheumatism, but never to foul play.
"Villain! Scoundrel!" cried the colonel.
We have here the explanation of why John Straker wished to take the horse out onto the moor. So spirited a creature would have certainly roused the soundest of sleepers when it felt the prick of the knife. It was absolutely necessary to do it in the open air.
"I have been blind!" cried the colonel. "Of course that was why he needed the candle and struck the match!"
"Undoubtedly. But in examining his belongings, I was fortunate enough to discover not only the method of the crime, but even its motives. As a man of the world, Colonel, you know that men do not carry other people's bills about in their pockets. We have most of us quite enough to do to settle our own. I at once concluded that Straker was leading a double life and keeping a second establishment. The nature of the bill showed that there was a lady in the case, and one who had expensive tastes. Liberal as you are with your servants, one can hardly expect that they can buy 20-guinea walking dresses for their ladies. I questioned Mrs. Straker as to the dress without her knowing it, and having satisfied myself that it had never reached her, I made a note of the milliner's address, and felt that by calling there with Straker's photograph, I could easily dispose of the mythical Derbyshire. From that time on, all was plain. Straker had led out the horse to a hollow where his light would be invisible. Simpson, in his flight, had dropped his cravat, and Straker had picked it up, with some idea perhaps that he might use it in securing the horse's leg. Once in the hollow, he had got behind the horse and had struck a light. But the creature, frightened at the sudden glare, and with the strange instinct of animals, feeling that some mischief was intended, had lashed out, and the steel shoe had struck Straker full on the forehead. He had already, in spite of the rain, taken off his overcoat in order to do his delicate task, and so, as he fell, his knife gashed his thigh. Do I make it clear?
"Wonderful!" cried the colonel. "Wonderful! You might have been there!"
My final shot was, I confess, a very long one. It struck me that so astute a man as Straker would not undertake this delicate tendon-nicking without a little practice. What could he practice on? My eyes fell upon the sheep, and I asked a question which, rather to my surprise, showed that my surmise was correct. When I returned to London, I called upon the milliner, who had recognised Straker as an excellent customer of the name of Derbyshire, who had a very dashing wife with a strong partiality for expensive dresses. I have no doubt that this woman had plunged him over head and ears in debt, and so led him into this miserable plot.
"You have explained all but one thing," cried the colonel. "Where was the horse?"
"Ah, it bolted, and was cared for by one of your neighbours. We must have an amnesty in that direction, I think. This is Clapham Junction, if I'm not mistaken, and we shall be in Victoria in less than 10 minutes. If you care to smoke a cigar in our rooms, Colonel, I shall be happy to give you any other details which might interest you.
The Adventure of the Cardboard Box.
In choosing a few typical cases which illustrate the remarkable mental qualities of my friend Sherlock Holmes, I have endeavoured, as far as possible, to select those which presented the minimum of sensationalism while offering a fair field for his talents. It is, however, unfortunately impossible entirely to separate the sensational from the criminal, and a chronicler is left in the dilemma that he must either sacrifice details which are essential to his statement, and so give a false impression of the problem, or he must use matter which chance, and not choice, has provided him with. With this short preface, I shall turn to my notes of what proved to be a strange, though a peculiarly terrible, chain of events. It was a blazing hot day in August. Baker Street was like an oven, and the glare of the sunlight upon the yellow brickwork of the house across the road was painful to the eye. It was hard to believe that these were the same walls which loomed so gloomily through the fogs of winter. Our blinds were half-drawn, and Holmes lay curled upon the sofa, reading and re-reading a letter which he had received by the morning post. For myself, my term of service in India had trained me to stand heat better than cold, and a thermometer at 90 was no hardship. But the morning paper was uninteresting. Parliament had risen, everybody was out of town, and I yearned for the glades of the New Forest or the shingle of Southsea. A depleted bank account had caused me to postpone my holiday, and as to my companion, neither the country nor the sea presented the slightest attraction to him. He loved to lie in the very centre of 5 millions of people, with his filaments stretching out and running through them, responsive to every little rumour or suspicion of unsolved crime. Appreciation of nature found no place among his many gifts, and his only change was when he turned his mind from the evil-doer of the town to track down his brother of the country. Finding that Holmes was too absorbed for conversation, I had tossed aside the barren paper, and leaning back in my chair, I fell into a brown study. Suddenly, my companion's voice broke in upon my thoughts. "You are right, Watson," said he. "It does seem a most preposterous way of settling a dispute." "Most preposterous," I exclaimed. And then, suddenly realizing how he had echoed the inmost thought of my soul, I sat up in my chair and stared at him in blank amazement. "What is this, Holmes?" I cried. "This is beyond anything which I could have imagined." He laughed heartily at my perplexity. "You remember," said he, "that some little time ago, when I read you the passage in one of Poe's sketches, in which a close reasoner follows the unspoken thoughts of his companion, you were inclined to treat the matter as a mere tour de force of the author. On my remarking that I was constantly in the habit of doing the same thing, you expressed incredulity." "Oh, no. Perhaps not with your tongue, my dear Watson, but certainly with your eyebrows. So when I saw you throw down your paper and enter upon a train of thought, I was very happy to have the opportunity of reading it off, and eventually of breaking into it as a proof that I had been in rapport with you." But I was still far from satisfied. "In the example which you read to me," said I, "the reasoner drew his conclusions from the actions of the man whom he observed. If I remember right, he stumbled over a heap of stones, looked up at the stars, and so on. But I have been seated quietly in my chair. And what clues can I have given you?" "You do yourself an injustice.
The features are given to man as the means by which he shall express his emotions, and yours are faithful servants.
Do you mean to say that you read my train of thoughts from my features?
Your features, and especially your eyes. Perhaps you cannot yourself recall how your reverie commenced?
No, I cannot.
Then I will tell you. After throwing down your paper, which was the action which drew my attention to you, you sat for half a minute with a vacant expression. Then your eyes fixed themselves upon your newly framed picture of General Gordon, and I saw by the alteration in your face that a train of thought had been started. But it did not lead very far. Your eyes flashed across to the unframed portrait of Henry Ward Beecher, which stands upon the top of your books. Then you glanced up at the wall, and of course your meaning was obvious. You were thinking that if the portrait were framed, it would just cover that bare space and correspond with Gordon's picture over there.
"You have followed me wonderfully," I exclaimed.
So far I could hardly have gone astray. But now your thoughts went back to Beecher, and you looked hard across, as if you were studying the character in his features. Then your eyes ceased to pucker, but you continued to look across, and your face was thoughtful. You were recalling the incidents of Beecher's career. I was well aware that you could not do this without thinking of the mission which he undertook on behalf of the North at the time of the Civil War, for I remember your expressing your passionate indignation at the way in which he was received by the more turbulent of our people. You felt so strongly about it that I knew you could not think of Beecher without thinking of that also. When a moment later I saw your eyes wander away from the picture, I suspected that your mind had now turned to the Civil War, and when I observed that your lips set, your eyes sparkled, and your hands clenched, I was positive that you were indeed thinking of the gallantry which was shown by both sides in that desperate struggle. But then again, your face grew sadder, you shook your head. You were dwelling upon the sadness and horror and useless waste of life. Your hand stole towards your own old wound, and a smile quivered on your lips, which showed me that the ridiculous side of this method of settling international questions had forced itself upon your mind. At this point, I agreed with you that it was preposterous, and was glad to find that all my deductions had been correct.
"Absolutely," said I.
"And now that you have explained it, I confess that I am as amazed as before." "It was very superficial, my dear Watson, I assure you. I should not have intruded it upon your attention had you not shown some incredulity the other day. But I have in my hands here a little problem, which may prove to be more difficult of solution than my small essay in thought-reading. Have you observed in the paper a short paragraph referring to the remarkable contents of a packet sent through the post to Miss Cushing of Cross Street, Croydon?"
"No, I saw nothing."
"Ah, then you must have overlooked it. Just toss it over to me. Here it is, under the financial column. Perhaps you would be good enough to read it aloud."
I picked up the paper, which he had thrown back to me, and read the paragraph indicated. It was headed, "A Gruesome Packet. Miss Susan Cushing, living at Cross Street, Croydon, has been made the victim of what must be regarded as a peculiarly revolting practical joke, unless some more sinister meaning should prove to be attached to the incident. At 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, a small packet wrapped in brown paper was handed in by the postman. A cardboard box was inside, which was filled with coarse salt. On emptying this, Miss Cushing was horrified to find 2 human ears, apparently quite freshly severed. The box had been sent by parcel post from Belfast upon the morning before. There is no indication as to the sender, and the matter is the more mysterious, as Miss Cushing, who is a maiden lady of 50, has led a most retired life, and has so few acquaintances or correspondents
that it is a rare event for her to receive anything through the post. Some years ago, however, when she resided at Penge, she let apartments in her house to 3 young medical students, whom she was obliged to get rid of on account of their noisy and irregular habits. The police are of opinion that this outrage may have been perpetrated upon Miss Cushing by these youths, who owed her a grudge and who hoped to frighten her by sending her these relics of the dissecting rooms. Some probability is lent to the theory by the fact that one of these students came from the north of Ireland, and to the best of Miss Cushing's belief, from Belfast. In the meantime, the matter is being actively investigated, Mr. Lestrade, one of the very smartest of our detective officers, being in charge of the case. So much for the Daily Chronicle, said Holmes as I finished reading. Now for our friend Lestrade. I had a note from him this morning in which he says, I think that this case is very much in your line. We have every hope of clearing the matter up, but we find a little difficulty in getting anything to work upon. We have, of course, wired to the Belfast post office, but a large number of parcels were handed in upon that day, and they have no means of identifying this particular one or of remembering the sender. The box is a half-pound box of honeydew tobacco, and does not help us in any way. The medical student theory still appears to me to be the most feasible, but if you should have a few hours to spare, I should be very happy to see you out here. I shall be either at the house or in the police station all day. What say you, Watson? Can you rise superior to the heat and run down to Croydon with me on the off chance of a case for your annals? I was longing for something to do. You shall have it, then. Ring for our boots and tell them to order a cab. I'll be back in a moment when I've changed my dressing gown and filled my cigar case. A shower of rain fell while we were in the train, and the heat was far less oppressive in Croydon than in town. Holmes had sent on a wire so that Lestrade, as wiry, as dapper, and as ferret-like as ever, was waiting for us at the station. A walk of 5 minutes took us to Cross Street, where Miss Cushing resided. It was a very long street of 2-story brick houses, neat and prim, with whitened stone steps and little groups of aproned women gossiping at the doors. Halfway down, Lestrade stopped and tapped at a door, which was opened by a small servant girl. Miss Cushing was sitting in the front room into which we were ushered. She was a placid-faced woman, with large, gentle eyes and grizzled hair curving down over her temples on each side. A worked antimacassar lay upon her lap, and a basket of coloured silks stood upon a stool beside her. "They are in the outhouse, those dreadful things," said she, as Lestrade entered. "I wish that you would take them away altogether."
"So I shall, Miss Cushing. I only kept them here until my friend, Mr. Holmes, should have seen them in your presence."
"Why in my presence, sir?"
"In case he wished to ask any questions."
"What is the use of asking me questions when I tell you I know nothing whatever about it?"
"Quite so, madam," said Holmes, in his soothing way. "I have no doubt that you have been annoyed more than enough already over this business."
"Indeed I have, sir. I am a quiet woman, and live a retired life. It is something new for me to see my name in the papers, and to find the police in my house. I won't have those things in here, Mr. Lestrade. If you wish to see them, you must go to the outhouse."
It was a small shed in the narrow garden which ran behind the house. Lestrade went in and brought out a yellow cardboard box with a piece of brown paper and some string. There was a bench at the end of the path, and we all sat down while Holmes examined, one by one, the articles which Lestrade had handed to him.
"The string is extremely interesting," he remarked, holding it up to the light and sniffing at it. "What do you make of this string, Lestrade?"
"It has been tarred."
"Precisely. It is a piece of tarred twine. You have also, no doubt, remarked that Miss Cushing has cut the cord with the scissors, as can be seen by the double fray on each side. This is of importance."
"'I cannot see the importance,' said Lestrade.
"'The importance lies in the fact that the knot is left intact, "'and that this knot is of a peculiar character.
"'It is very neatly tied. "'I had already made a note to that effect,' said Lestrade complacently.
"'So much for the string, then,' said Holmes, smiling.
"'Now for the box wrapper. "'Brown paper with a distinct smell of coffee. "'What? Did you not observe it? "'I think there can be no doubt of it. "'Address printed in rather straggling characters. "'Miss S. Cushing, Cross Street, Croydon, "'done with a broad-pointed pen, probably a J, "'and with very inferior ink.' The word Croydon has been originally spelled with an I, which has been changed to Y. The parcel was directed then by a man, the printing is distinctly masculine, of limited education and unacquainted with the town of Croydon. So far, so good. The box is a yellow half-pound honeydew box, with nothing distinctive save two thumb marks at the left bottom corner. It is filled with rough salt of the quality used for preserving hides and other of the coarser commercial purposes, and embedded in it are these very singular enclosures. He took out the two ears as he spoke, and laying a board across his knee, he examined them minutely, while Lestrade and I, bending forward on each side of him, glanced alternately at these dreadful relics, and at the thoughtful, eager face of our companion. Finally, he returned them to the box once more, and sat for a while in deep meditation. "'You have observed, of course,' said he at last, "'that the ears are not a pair. "'Yes, I have noticed that, "'but if this were the practical joke of some students from the dissecting rooms, "'it would be as easy for them to send two odd ears as a pair. "'Precisely.' But this is not a practical joke. You are sure of it? The presumption is strongly against it. Bodies in the dissecting rooms are injected with preservative fluid. These ears bear no signs of this. They are fresh, too. They have been cut off with a blunt instrument, which would hardly happen if a student had done it. Again, carbolic or rectified spirits would be the preservatives which would suggest themselves to the medical mind. Certainly not rough salt. I repeat that there is no practical joke here, but that we are investigating a serious crime. A vague thrill ran through me as I listened to my companion's words and saw the stern gravity which had hardened his features. This brutal preliminary seemed to shadow forth some strange and inexplicable horror in the background. Lestrade, however, shook his head like a man who is only half convinced.
"'There are objections to the joke theory, no doubt,' said he, "'but there are much stronger reasons against the other. "'We know that this woman has led a most quiet and respectable life at Penge, "'and here for the last 20 years. "'She has hardly been away from her home for a day during that time. "'Why on earth, then, should any criminal send her the proofs of his guilt, "'especially as, unless she is a most consummate actress,' "'She understands quite as little of the matter as we do. "'That is the problem which we have to solve,' Holmes answered, "'and for my part I shall set about it by presuming that my reasoning is correct, "'and that a double murder has been committed. "'One of these ears is a woman's, small, finely formed, and pierced for an earring. "'The other is a man's, sunburned, discoloured, and also pierced for an earring.' These two people are presumably dead, or we should have heard their story before now. Today is Friday. The packet was posted on Thursday morning. The tragedy then occurred on Wednesday or Tuesday or earlier. If the two people were murdered, who but their murderer would have sent this sign of his work to Miss Cushing? We may take it that the sender of the packet is the man whom we want, but he must have some strong reason. "'For sending Miss Cushing this packet. "'What reason, then? "'It must have been to tell her that the deed was done, "'or to pain her, perhaps. "'But in that case she knows who it is. "'Does she know? I doubt it. "'If she knew, why should she call the police in? "'She might have buried the ears, and no one would have been the wiser.
That is what she would have done if she had wished to shield the criminal. But if she does not wish to shield him, she would give his name. There is a tangle here which needs straightening out.
He had been talking in a high, quick voice, staring blankly up over the garden fence, but now he sprang briskly to his feet and walked towards the house.
"I have a few questions to ask Miss Cushing," said he.
"In that case I may leave you here," said Lestrade, "for I have another small business on hand. I think that I have nothing further to learn from Miss Cushing. You will find me at the police station."
"We shall look in on our way to the train," answered Holmes. A moment later he and I were back in the front room, where the impassive lady was still quietly working away at her antimacassar. She put it down on her lap as we entered, and looked at us with her frank, searching blue eyes.
"I am convinced, sir," she said, "that this matter is a mistake, and that the parcel was never meant for me at all. I have said this several times to the gentleman from Scotland Yard, but he simply laughs at me. I have not an enemy in the world, as far as I know, so why should anyone play me such a trick?"
"I am coming to be of the same opinion, Miss Cushing," said Holmes, taking a seat beside her. "I think that it is more than probable."
He paused, and I was surprised, on glancing round, to see that he was staring with singular intentness at the lady's profile. Surprise and satisfaction were both in an instant to be read upon his eager face, though when she glanced round to find out the cause of his silence, he had become as demure as ever. I stared hard myself at her flat, grizzled hair, her trim cap, her little gilt earrings, her placid features, but I could see nothing which could account for my companion's evident excitement.
"There were one or two questions."
"Oh, I am weary of questions," cried Miss Cushing impatiently.
"You have two sisters, I believe."
"How could you know that?"
"I observed the very instant that I entered the room that you have a portrait group of three ladies upon the mantelpiece, one of whom is undoubtedly yourself, while the others are so exceedingly like you that there could be no doubt of the relationship."
"Yes, you are quite right. Those are my sisters, Sarah and Mary.
And here at my elbow is another portrait, taken at Liverpool, of your younger sister, in the company of a man who appears to be a steward by his uniform. I observed that she was unmarried at the time."
"You are very quick at observing." "That is my trade."
"Well, you are quite right. But she was married to Mr. Browner a few days afterwards. He was on the South American line when that was taken, but he was so fond of her that he couldn't abide to leave her for so long, and he got into the Liverpool and London boats."
"Ah, the Conqueror, perhaps."
"No, the May Day, when I last heard. Jim came down here to see me once. That was before he broke the pledge. But afterwards he would always take drink when he was ashore, and the little drink would send him stark, staring mad. Oh, it was a bad day that ever he took a glass in his hand again. First he dropped me, then he quarrelled with Sarah, and now that Mary has stopped writing, we don't know how things are going with them."
It was evident that Miss Cushing had come upon a subject on which she felt very deeply. Like most people who lead a lonely life, she was shy at first, but ended by becoming extremely communicative. She told us many details about her brother-in-law, the steward, and then, wandering off on the subject of her former lodgers, the medical students, she gave us a long account of their delinquencies, with their names and those of their hospitals. Holmes listened attentively to everything, throwing in a question from time to time.
"About your second sister, Sarah," said he, "I wonder, since you are both maiden ladies, that you do not keep house together?"
"Ah, you don't know Sarah's temper, or you would wonder no more. I tried it when I came to Croydon, and we kept on until about 2 months ago, when we had to part. I don't want to say a word against my own sister, but she was always meddlesome and hard to please, was Sarah."
"You say that she quarrelled with your Liverpool relations?"
"Yes, and they were the best of friends at one time.
why she went up there to live in order to be near them. And now she has no word hard enough for Jim Browner. The last 6 months that she was here, she would speak of nothing but his drinking and his ways. He had caught her meddling, I suspect, and given her a bit of his mind, and that was the start of it. "Thank you, Miss Cushing," said Holmes, rising and bowing. "Your sister Sarah lives, I think you said, at New Street, Wallington. Good-bye, and I'm very sorry that you should have been troubled over a case with which, as you say, you have nothing whatever to do." There was a cab passing as we came out, and Holmes hailed it. "How far to Wallington?" he asked. "Only about a mile, sir." "Very good. Jump in, Watson. We must strike while the iron is hot. Simple as the case is, there have been one or two very instructive details in connection with it. Just pull up at a telegraph office as you pass, cabby." Holmes sent off a short wire, and for the rest of the drive lay back in the cab, with his hat tilted over his nose to keep the sun from his face. Our driver pulled up at a house which was not unlike the one which we had just quitted. My companion ordered him to wait, and had his hand upon the knocker when the door opened, and a grave young gentleman in black, with a very shiny hat, appeared on the step. "Is Miss Cushing at home?" asked Holmes. "Miss Sarah Cushing is extremely ill," said he. "She has been suffering since yesterday from brain symptoms of great severity. As her medical adviser, I cannot possibly take the responsibility of allowing anyone to see her. I should recommend you to call again in 10 days." He drew on his gloves, closed the door, and marched off down the street. "Well, if we can't, we can't," said Holmes cheerfully. "Perhaps she could not or would not have told you much. I did not wish her to tell me anything. I only wanted to look at her. However, I think that I've got all that I want. Drive us to some decent hotel, cabby, where we may have some lunch, and afterwards we shall drop down upon friend Lestrade at the police station." We had a pleasant little meal together, during which Holmes would talk about nothing but violins, narrating with great exultation how he had purchased his own Stradivarius, which was worth at least 500 guineas, at a Jew broker's in Tottenham Court Road for 55 shillings. This led him to Paganini, and we sat for an hour over a bottle of claret, while he told me anecdote after anecdote of that extraordinary man. The afternoon was far advanced, and the hot glare had softened into a mellow glow before we found ourselves at the police station. Lestrade was waiting for us at the door. "A telegram for you, Mr. Holmes," said he. "Ha! It is the answer." He tore it open, glanced his eyes over it, and crumpled it into his pocket. "That's all right," said he. "Have you found out anything?" "I have found out everything." "What?" Lestrade stared at him in amazement. "You are joking." "I was never more serious in my life. A shocking crime has been committed, and I think I have now laid bare every detail of it." "And the criminal?" Holmes scribbled a few words upon the back of one of his visiting cards and threw it over to Lestrade. "That is the name," he said. "You cannot effect an arrest until tomorrow night at the earliest. I should prefer that you do not mention my name at all in connection with the case, as I choose to be only associated with those crimes which present some difficulty in their solution. Come on, Watson." We strode off together to the station, leaving Lestrade still staring with a delighted face at the card which Holmes had thrown him. "The case," said Sherlock Holmes, as we chatted over our cigars that night in our rooms at Baker Street, "is one where, as in the investigations which you have chronicled under the names of A Study in Scarlet,